Chapter 9. Elucidation by a Spacer. The minutes passed, and the buzzing grew louder and drowned out the laughter. The dome and all it contained wavered, and Bailey's time sense wavered too. At least, he found himself sitting in an unchanged position, but with a definite feeling of lost time. The commissioner was gone. The trimensic receiver was milky and opaque, and R. Daniil sat at his side, pinching up the skin of Bailey's bared upper arm. Bailey could see, just beneath the skin, the small, thin darkness of a hyposliver. It vanished as he watched, soaking and spreading away into the intercellular fluid, from that into the bloodstream and the neighboring cells, from that into all the cells of his body. His grip on reality heightened.
"Do you feel better, Partner Elijah?" asked R. Daniil.
Bailey did. He pulled at his arm and the robot let him take it away. He rolled down his sleeve and looked about. Dr. Fastolf sat where he had been, a small smile softening the homeliness of his face. Bailey said,
"Did I black out?"
Dr. Fastolf said,
"In a way, yes. You received a sizable shock, I'm afraid."
It came back to Bailey quite clearly. He seized R. Daniil's nearer arm quickly, forcing up the sleeve as far as it would go, exposing the wrist. The robot's flesh felt soft to his fingers, but underneath was the hardness of something more than bone. R. Daniil let his arm rest easily in the plainclothesman's grip. Bailey stared at it, pinching the skin along the median line. Was there a faint seam? It was logical, of course, that there should be. A robot, covered with synthetic skin and deliberately made to look human, could not be repaired in the ordinary fashion. A chest plate could not be unriveted for the purpose. A skull could not be hinged up and outward. Instead, the various parts of the mechanical body would have to be put together along a line of micromagnetic fields. An arm, a head, an entire body must fall in two at the proper touch, then come together again at a contrary touch. Bailey looked up.
"Where's the commissioner?"
he mumbled, hot with mortification.
"Pressing business," said Dr. Fastolf. "I encouraged him to leave, I'm afraid. I assured him we would take care of you."
"You've taken care of me quite nicely already, thank you," said Bailey grimly. "I think our business is done."
He lifted himself erect on tired joints. He felt an old man very suddenly. Too old to start over again. He needed no deep insight to foresee that future. The commissioner would be half frightened and half furious. He would face Bailey whitely, taking his glasses off to wipe them every 15 seconds. His soft voice, Julius Enderby almost never shouted, would explain carefully that the spacers had been mortally offended.
"You can't talk to spacers that way, Lige. They won't take it."
Bailey could hear Enderby's voice very plainly down to the finest shade of intonation.
"I warned you. No saying how much damage you've done. I can see your point, mind you. I see what you were trying to do. If they were Earthmen, it would be different. I'd say yes, chance it, run the risk, smoke them out. But spacers! You might have told me, Lige. You might have consulted me. I know them. I know them inside and out."
And what would Bailey be able to say? That Enderby was exactly the man he couldn't tell. That the project was one of tremendous risk, and Enderby a man of tremendous caution. That it had been Enderby himself who had pointed up the supreme dangers of either outright failure or of the wrong kind of success. That the one way of defeating declassification was to show that guilt lay in Spacetown itself. Enderby would say,
"There'll have to be a report on this, Lige. There'll be all sorts of repercussions. I know the spacers. They'll demand your removal from the case, and it'll have to be that way. You understand that, Lige, don't you? I'll try to make it easy on you. You can count on that. I'll protect you as far as I can, Lige."
Bailey knew that would be exactly true. The commissioner would protect him, but only as far as he could, not to the point, for instance, of infuriating further an angry mayor. He could hear the mayor, too. "Damn it, Enderby, what is all this? Why wasn't I consulted? Who's running the city? Why was an unauthorized robot allowed inside the city? And just what the devil did this Bailey?" If it came to a choice between Bailey's future in the department and the commissioner's own, what possible result could Bailey expect? He could find no reasonable way of blaming Enderby. The least he could expect was demotion, and that was bad enough. The mere act of living in a modern city ensured the bare possibility of existence, even for those entirely declassified. How bare that possibility was, he knew only too well. It was the addition of status that brought the little things, a more comfortable seat here, a better cut of meat there, a shorter wait in line at the other place. To the philosophical mind, these items might seem scarcely worth any great trouble to acquire. Yet no one, however philosophical, could give up those privileges once acquired without a pang. That was the point. What a trifling addition to the convenience of the apartment an activated wash basin was, when for 30 years previously the trip to personal had been an automatic and unregarded one. How useless it was, even as a device to prove status, when it was considered the height of ill form to parade status. Yet were the wash basin to be deactivated, how humiliating and unbearable would each added trip to personal be. How yearningly attractive the memory of the bedroom shave. How filled with a sense of lost luxury. It was fashionable for modern political writers to look back with a smug disapproval at the fiscalism of medieval times, when economy was based on money. The competitive struggle for existence, they said, was brutal. No truly complex society could be maintained because of the strains introduced by the eternal fight for the buck. Scholars had varying interpretations of the word buck, but there was no dispute over the meaning as a whole. By contrast, modern civism was praised highly as efficient and enlightened. Maybe so. There were historical novels, both in the romantic and the sensational tradition, and the medievalists thought fiscalism had bred such things as individualism and initiative. Bailey wouldn't commit himself, but now he wondered sickly if ever a man fought harder for that buck, whatever it was, or felt its loss more deeply than a city dweller fought to keep from losing his Sunday night option on a chicken drumstick. A real flesh drumstick from a once-living bird. Bailey thought, "Not me so much. There's Jesse and Ben." Dr. Fastolf's voice broke in upon his thoughts.
"Mr. Bailey, do you hear me?"
Bailey blinked.
"Yes?"
How long had he been standing there like a frozen fool?
"Won't you sit down, sir? Having taken care of the matter on your mind, you may now be interested in some films we have taken of the scene of the crime and of the events immediately following."
No, thank you. I have business in the city."
"Surely the case of Dr. Sarton comes first."
"Not with me. I imagine I'm off the case already."
Suddenly he boiled over.
"Damn it! If you could prove R. Daniil was a robot, why didn't you do it at once? Why did you make such a farce of it all?"
"My dear Mr. Bailey, I was very interested in your deductions. As for being off the case, I doubt it. Before the commissioner left, I made a special point of asking that you be retained. I believe he will cooperate."
Bailey sat down, not entirely voluntarily. He said sharply,
"Why?"
Dr. Fastolf crossed his legs and sighed.
"Mr. Bailey, in general I have met two kinds of city dwellers, rioters and politicians. Your commissioner is useful to us, but he is a politician. He tells us what we want to hear. He handles us, if you know what I mean. Now you came here and boldly accused us of tremendous crimes and tried to prove your case.
I enjoyed the process. I found it a hopeful development.
How hopeful? Asked Bailey sardonically.
Hopeful enough. You are someone I can deal with frankly. Last night, Mr. Bailey, R. Daniil reported to me by shielded sub-ether. Some things about you interested me very much. For instance, there was the point concerning the nature of the book films in your apartment.
What about them?
A good many dealt with historical and archaeological subjects. It makes it appear that you are interested in human society and that you know a little about its evolution.
Even a policeman can spend their free time on book films if they so choose.
Quite. I'm glad of your choice in viewing matter. It will help me in what I am trying to do. In the first place, I want to explain, or try to, the exclusivism of the men of the outer worlds. We live here in Spacetown. We don't enter the city. We mingle with you city dwellers only in a very rigidly limited fashion. We breathe the open air, but when we do, we wear filters. I sit here now with filters in my nostrils, gloves on my hands, and a fixed determination to come no closer to you than I can help. Why do you suppose that is?
Bailey said, There's no point in guessing. Let him talk now.
If you guessed, as some of your people do, you would say that it was because we despised the men of Earth and refused to lose caste by allowing their shadow to fall upon us. That is not so. The true answer is really quite obvious. The medical examination you went through, as well as the cleansing procedures, were not matters of ritual. They were dictated by necessity.
Disease?
Yes, disease. My dear Mr. Bailey, the Earthmen who colonized the outer worlds found themselves on planets entirely free of terrestrial bacteria and viruses. They brought in their own, of course, but they also brought with them the latest medical and microbiological techniques. They had a small community of microorganisms to deal with and no intermediate hosts. There were no mosquitoes to spread malaria, no snails to spread schistosomiasis. Disease agents were wiped out and symbiotic bacteria allowed to grow. Gradually, the outer worlds became disease-free. Naturally, as time went on, entrance requirements for immigrant Earthmen were made more and more rigorous, since less and less could the outer worlds endure the possible introduction of disease.
You've never been sick, Dr. Fastolf?
Not with a parasitic disease, Mr. Bailey. We are all liable to degenerative diseases such as atherosclerosis, of course, but I have never had what you would call a cold. If I were to contract one, I might die of it. I've built up no resistance to it whatsoever. That's what's wrong with us here in Spacetown. Those of us who come here run a definite risk. Earth is riddled with diseases to which we have no defense, no natural defense. You yourself are carrying the germs of almost every known disease. You are not aware of it, since you keep them all under control at almost all times through the antibodies your body has developed over the years. I myself lack the antibodies. Do you wonder that I come no closer to you? Believe me, Mr. Bailey, I act aloof only in self-defense.
Bailey said, If this is so, why isn't the fact made known on Earth? I mean that it is not just queasiness on your part, but a defense against an actual physical danger. The spacer shook his head.
We are few, Mr. Bailey, and are disliked as foreigners anyway. We maintain our own safety on the basis of a rather shaky prestige as a superior class of being. We cannot afford to lose face by admitting that we are afraid to approach an Earthman. Not at least until there is a better understanding between Earthmen and spacers.
Well, there won't be on present terms. It's your supposed superiority that they hate you for.
It is a dilemma. Don't think we aren't aware of it.
Does the Commissioner know of this?
We have never explained it to him flatly, as I have just done to you. He may guess it, however. He is quite an intelligent man.
If he guessed it, he might have told me, Bailey said reflectively. Dr. Fastolf lifted his eyebrows.
If he had, then you wouldn't have considered the possibility of R. Daniil being a human spacer. Is that it?
Bailey shrugged slightly. tossing the matter to one side. But Dr. Fastolf went on.
That's quite true, you know. Putting the psychological difficulties to one side, the terrible effect of the noise and crowds upon us, the fact remains that for one of us to enter the city is the equivalent of a death sentence. It is why Dr. Sarton initiated his project of humanoid robots. They were substitute men, designed to enter the city instead of us.
Yes, Ardenil explained this to me.
Do you disapprove?
Look, said Bailey,
since we're talking to one another so freely, let me ask a question in simple words. Why have you spacers come to Earth anyway? Why don't you leave us alone?
Dr. Fastolf said, with obvious surprise,
Are you satisfied with life on Earth?
We get along.
Yes, but for how long will that continue? Your population goes up continuously. The available calories meet the needs only as a result of greater and greater effort. Earth is in a blind alley, man.
We get along, repeated Bailey stubbornly.
Barely. A city like New York must spend every ounce of effort getting water in and waste out. The nuclear power plants are kept going by uranium supplies that are constantly more difficult to obtain even from the other planets of the system, and the supply needed goes up steadily. The life of the city depends every moment on the arrival of wood pulp for the yeast vats and minerals for the hydroponic plants. Air must be circulated unceasingly. The balance is a very delicate one in 100 directions and growing more delicate each year. What would happen to New York if the tremendous flow of input and outgo were to be interrupted for even a single hour?
It never has been.
Which is no security for the future. In primitive times, individual population centers were virtually self-supporting, living on the produce of neighboring farms. Nothing but immediate disaster, a flood or a pestilence or a crop failure, could harm them. As the centers grew and technology improved, localized disasters could be overcome by drawing on help from distant centers, but at the cost of making even larger areas interdependent. In medieval times, the open cities, even the largest, could subsist on food stores and on emergency supplies of all sorts for a week at least. When New York first became a city, it could have lived on itself for a day. Now it cannot do so for an hour. A disaster that would have been uncomfortable 10,000 years ago, merely serious 1,000 years ago, and acute 100 years ago, would now be surely fatal.
Bailey moved restlessly in his chair.
I've heard all this before. The medievalists want an end to cities. They want us to get back to the soil and to natural agriculture. Well, they're mad. We can't. There are too many of us, and you can't go backward in history, only forward. Of course, if emigration to the outer worlds were not restricted,
you know why it must be restricted.
Then what is there to do? You're tapping a dead power line.
What about emigration to new worlds?
There are 100 billion stars in the galaxy. It is estimated that there are 100 billion stars in the galaxy. It is estimated that there are 100 million planets that are inhabitable or can be made inhabitable.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Why?
Asked Dr. Fastolf with vehemence.
Why is the suggestion ridiculous? Earthmen have colonized planets in the past. Over 30 of the 50 outer worlds, including my native Aurora, were directly colonized by Earthmen. Is colonization no longer possible?
No
answer. Well, let me suggest that if it is no longer possible, it is because of the development of city culture on Earth. Before the cities, human life on Earth wasn't so specialized that they couldn't break loose and start all over on a raw world. They did it 30 times. But now, Earthmen are all so coddled, so enwombed in their imprisoning caves of steel that they are caught forever. You, Mr. Bailey, won't even believe that a city dweller is capable of crossing country to get to Spacetown. Crossing space to get to a new world must represent impossibility squared to you. Civism is ruining Earth, sir.
Bailey said angrily.
And if it does, how does it concern you people? It's our problem. We'll solve it. If not, it's our own particular road to hell.
Better your own road to hell than another's road to heaven, eh? I know how you must feel.
It is not pleasant to listen to the preaching of a stranger. Yet I wish your people could preach to us, for we too have a problem, one that is quite analogous to yours."
Bailey smiled crookedly.
"Overpopulation? Analogous, not identical. Ours is underpopulation. How old would you say I was?"
The Earthman considered for a moment, and then deliberately overestimated.
60, I'd say. 160, you should say.
What?
163 next birthday, to be exact. There's no trick to that. I'm using the standard Earth year as the unit. If I'm fortunate, if I take care of myself, most of all, if I catch no disease on Earth, I may double that age. Men on Aurora have been known to live over 350 years, and life expectancy is still increasing.
Bailey looked to R. Daniil, who throughout the conversation had been listening in stolid silence, as though he were seeking confirmation. He said,
"How is that possible?"
"In an underpopulated society, it is practical to concentrate study on gerontology, to do research on the aging process. In a world such as yours, a lengthened life expectancy would be disastrous. You couldn't afford the resulting rise in population. On Aurora, there is room for tricentenarians. Then, of course, a long life becomes doubly and triply precious. If you were to die now, you would lose perhaps 40 years of your life, probably less. If I were to die, I would lose 150 years, probably more. In a culture such as ours, then, individual life is of prime importance. Our birth rate is low, and population increase is rigidly controlled. We maintain a definite robot-man ratio, designed to maintain the individual in the greatest comfort. Logically, developing children are carefully screened for physical and mental defects before being allowed to mature."
Bailey interrupted.
"You mean you kill them if they don't?" "If they don't measure up. Quite painlessly, I assure you." "The notion shocks you, just as the Earthman's uncontrolled breeding shocks us."
"We're controlled, Dr. Fastolf. Each family is allowed so many children."
Dr. Fastolf smiled tolerantly.
"So many of any kind of children, not so many healthy children. And even so, there are many illegitimates, and your population increases."
"Who's to judge which children should live?"
"Well, that's rather complicated and not to be answered in a sentence. Someday we may talk it out in detail." "Well, where's your problem? You sound satisfied with your society." "It is stable. That's the trouble. It is too stable."
Bailey said,
"Nothing pleases you. Our civilization is at the ragged edge of chaos, according to you, and your own is too stable."
"It is possible to be too stable. No outer world has colonized a new planet in 2.5 centuries. There is no prospect for colonization in the future. Our lives in the outer worlds are too long to risk and too comfortable to upset."
"I don't know about that, Dr. Fastolf. You've come to Earth. You risk disease."
"Yes, I do. There are some of us, Mr. Bailey, who feel that the future of the human race is even worth the possible loss of an extended lifetime. Too few of us, I am sorry to say."
"All right, we're coming to the point. How is Spacetown helping matters?"
"In trying to introduce robots here on Earth, we're doing our best to upset the balance of your city economy."
"That's your way of helping?"
Bailey's lips quivered.
"You mean you're creating a growing group of displaced and declassified men on purpose?"
"Not out of cruelty or callousness, believe me. A group of displaced men, as you call them, are what we need to serve as a nucleus for colonization. Your ancient America was discovered by ships fitted out with men from the prisons. Don't you see that the city's womb has failed the displaced man? He has nothing to lose and worlds to gain by leaving Earth."
"But it isn't working."
"No, it isn't,"
said Dr. Fastolf sadly.
"There is something wrong. The resentment of the Earthman for the robot blocks things.
Yet those very robots can accompany humans, smooth the difficulties of initial adjustment to a raw world, make colonization practical.
Well, then what? More outer worlds?
No. The outer worlds were established before civism had spread over Earth, before the cities. The new colonies will be built by humans who have the city background plus the beginnings of a Sifi culture. It will be a synthesis, a crossbreeding. As it stands now, Earth's own structure must go ricketing down in the near future. The outer worlds will slowly degenerate and decay in a somewhat further future, but the new colonies will be a new and healthy strain, combining the best of both cultures. By their reaction upon the older worlds, including Earth, we ourselves may gain new life.
I don't know. It's all misty, Dr. Fastolf.
It's a dream, yes.
Think about it.
Abruptly, the spacer rose to his feet.
I have spent more time with you than I intended. In fact, more time than our health ordinances allow. You will excuse me.
Bailey and R. Daniil left the dome. Sunlight, at a different angle, somewhat yellower, washed down upon them once again. In Bailey there was a vague wonder whether sunlight might not seem different on another world. Less harsh and brazen, perhaps. More acceptable.
Another world.
The ugly spacer with the prominent ears had filled his mind with queer imaginings. Did the doctors of Aurora once look at the child Fastolf and wonder if he ought to be allowed to mature? Wasn't he too ugly? Or did their criteria include physical appearance at all? When did ugliness become a deformity? And what deformities? But when the sunlight vanished and they entered the first door that led to the personal, the mood became harder to maintain. Bailey shook his head with exasperation. It was all ridiculous, forcing Earthmen to emigrate, to set up a new society. It was nonsense. What were these spacers really after? He thought about it and came to no conclusion. Slowly, their squad car rolled down the vehicular lane. Reality was surging all about Bailey. His blaster was a warm and comfortable weight against his hip. The noise and vibrant life of the city was just as warm, just as comfortable. For a moment, as the city closed in, his nose tingled to a slight and fugitive pungence. He thought wonderingly, "The city smells." He thought of the 20 million human beings crammed into the steel walls of the great cave, and for the first time in his life, he smelled them with nostrils that had been washed clean by outdoor air. He thought, would it be different on another world? Less people and more air. Cleaner. But the afternoon roar of the city was all around them. The smell faded and was gone, and he felt a little ashamed of himself. He let the drive rod in slowly and tapped a larger share of the beamed power. The squad car accelerated sharply as it slanted down into the empty motorway.
"Daniil," he said.
"Yes, Elijah."
"Why was Dr. Fastolf telling me all he did?"
"It seems probable to me, Elijah, that he wished to impress you with the importance of the investigation. We are not here just to solve a murder, but to save Spacetown and, with it, the future of the human race."
Bailey said dryly, "I think he'd have been better off if he had let me see the scene of the crime and interview the men who first found the body."
"I doubt if you could have added anything, Elijah. We have been quite thorough."
"Have you? Well, you've got nothing, not a clue, not a suspect."
"No, you are right. The answer must be in the city. To be accurate, though, we did have one suspect."
"What? You said nothing of this before."
"I did not feel it to be necessary, Elijah. Surely it is obvious to you that one suspect automatically existed."
"Who? In the devil's name, who?"
"The one Earthman who was on the scene. Commissioner Julius Enderby."